Good evening, America. I'm Sam Thurman with Cliff Stewart and Ethel Lopez, and you are tuned to a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Cliff, Ethel, how you doing tonight?
Doing good, doing
great.
Good.
Thanks.
We have a full program this evening. We're going to talk about the high rate or the increasing rate of wrongful convictions. We have several guests that are going to be coming on later on to talk about that subject, and we have some good articles that's going to shed a little light on that. And then we also have an exoneree that's going to be coming on a little bit later as well. We always talk about the IRP-6. So we ask that you would continue to keep the IRP-6 in your prayers. That's Gary Walker, David Banks, Dave Zerpolo, Clinton Stewart, Demetrius Harper, and Kendrick Barnes. Their case is currently under appeal. We'll share a little bit more information about that here in a moment. Our disclaimer, Cliff, Ethel, and I are not attorneys, and a Just Cause Coast to Coast does not provide legal advice. So please contact your personal legal advisor for your legal needs. Also, the opinions expressed by the callers and guests on the program do not necessarily reflect that of a Just Cause or a Just Cause Coast to Coast. But as always, we truly, truly appreciate you taking time out and spending a little bit of time with us this evening. Now, on the IRP-6 case, just a quick reminder that their case is under appeal. But in the meantime, they have been incarcerated for 19 months, going on 20 months now. A key part of their appeal includes over 200 pages of a transcript that's missing, and we as a Just Cause are doing several things to bring awareness to that.
Exactly. And one of those things we're asking people to do is to call Attorney General Eric Holder's office at 202-514-2003 and 2005 and ask him to investigate what is going on with this case and that missing transcript.
And also, we have a petition out on change.org. Go to change.org, put in on the search window IRP-6. And sign that petition, sign it tonight, put in a comment there as well. Also, for information about the IRP-6 case, go to FreeTheIRP6. That's the number 6, FreeTheIRP6.org. For information about a Just Cause, go to a-justcause.com, a-justcause.com. Along that line, we're also seeking to build up our donor base. So we have a button on the website for donations. We are currently working on our 501c3, so we ask that you would, in the meantime, though, just because you believe in what A Just Cause is doing or organizations like A Just Cause that we may be affiliated with, we would appreciate your donation. If you'd like additional information also about AJC Radio, you can go to ajcradio.com. Okay, so on the program this evening, we're going to have Alan Newton. He's going to be our for our exoneree moment. Also, we're going to have Kara Dansky from the ACLU, and she's going to be talking about an article that was on Huffington Post today where Harry Belafonte is speaking out about the it basically says, let's fix a justice system that isn't working. So we're going to hit that in a moment. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, Ethel, what do we have in the news?
Well, I'm looking at an article here that was written. It's out of Reuters, and the title of it is Supreme Court makes it easier for police to search homes without a warrant. You know, and in this particular article, you know, this guy's name is Fernandez, Walter Fernandez. And what happened? He had a roommate, and I guess the FBI or the police was trying to search his home. He did not give consent for them to search, but his roommate, after he had left the scene, his roommate gave consent for the search. For them to search the man's home. So when it went to court, he was trying to get this thrown out because he said, you know, they did not have a search warrant and I did not give them consent to search, but they used the other person who was living in the dwelling given their consent to go ahead and search this man's place.
And not only did he not give consent, when mm-hmm. they asked him, he said no.
Exactly.
You cannot search my house. You don't have a search warrant.
That's right.
You're not coming in. Then he leaves.
Yes.
And his roommate lets yep. him in, and how does the Supreme Court hold that up? It's like you had no search warrant. Mm-mm. I told you cannot come in, so that's like okay. Let's put it in everybody's everyday terms. The police come to your house, say mm-hmm. we want to search your house. We think something's going on. I say no. Do you have a search warrant? You can't come in my house. Then I leave.
Right.
My son answers the door the next time they come. He said, hey, little boy, you're 13 years old. Are your parents home? No, they're not here. Is it okay if
you
let us in? We're the police. We got some badges. You can call and ask anybody.
Uh-huh.
And he says, okay, well, yeah, if you the cops, come on in. That is...
That's messed up.
That is against the law.
That's messed up.
And so many other things. That is ridiculous.
It is.
And, you know, I think another one of our guests that will be able to shed a little bit of light on that, that's a good segue to just kind of share who one of our other guests is Maurice Posley. And Maurice is a Pulitzer Prize winner journalist and an author. And he's doing a lot of investigative reporting on wrongful convictions.
Right.
And so... And just the misconduct that goes on behind the scenes, and
exactly.
You know, but then when you have something like this, where the Supreme Court is basically endorsing,
yes, they are
the wrongful activities within, that's crazy. And if you believe half the stuff that you see on some of the television shows, some of the cop shows, I wouldn't put it past a cop to say, hey, your dad sent me here and said, hey, he left something up in the bedroom.
Yeah.
I need to look around for it. You know, that's crazy.
That's the truth.
Man. So, Ethel, what else do we have in the news?
Another thing, you know, and this really thing, this thing really bothered me, you know, because this young lady, and we all know this story about Marissa Alexander out of Florida, okay, that, you know, she was been given a new trial and stuff like that, which is supposed to be taking place in July of this year. This rotten judge, Angela Corey, is seeking 60 years. 60. Not the 20 years that the girl was given, you know, previously at the first trial. Okay, this woman right here.
She's that special prosecutor, right?
She
messed up another case down there.
She cannot make stank stick on poo. But then she ends up giving this girl 60 years. I mean, you got these two jokers that killed these two young boys. She can't get a conviction out of either one of them. But then you get this girl who she's African-American. She takes the Stand Your Ground law, but then she gets sentenced to prison for 20 years. And now she wants to come back and say when she's retried, I'm going after 60.
And she fired a warning shot.
A warning shot.
And, she didn't kill anybody.
And this was a warning shot against her husband who had previously, you know, choked her out.
Yeah.
Punched her and all this stuff. So
and admitted it.
This is Stand Your Ground right
yeah,
here.
Yeah, you would almost think that Marissa would have got off better if she had just shot him.
If she would have shot him right in the chest.
Because the Stand Your Ground law would have given her every right to just say, hey, I felt threatened for my life.
Absolutely.
So I shot him.
Absolutely.
But you shoot a warning shot.
A warning shot.
And the prosecutor is going after you for 60
years.
60 years. I tell you what, that is just totally ridiculous.
And you know, one of the things that we were talking about before the show is that, you know, a lot of times we talk about wrongful convictions and exonerees and so forth. Well, this thing really does impact the female population in this country as well. And so, you know, we pulled this story and it says, you know, why is the female prisoner population skyrocketing? This one came from Care2, that's CARE, the number 2.com. Mm-hmm. And it says, you know, in the 1980s were a time of tough on crime laws.
Mm-hmm.
And at the start of the decade, there were approximately 13,000 women in prisons, representing 4% of the inmates in state and federal prisons. Over the next two decades, that the rate of incarceration accelerated and the rate of increase for women surpassed that of men in the same time period, the rate, you know, they're talking about.
Right.
In 2010, women represented 7% of the prison population. So in the 80s, 4%.
Mm-hmm.
By 2010, 7%.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the more than 200,000 women currently in prison are there for nonviolent crimes. Basically, the woman gets arrested as an accomplice.
Yeah.
I mean, we've heard horror stories of grandma getting
true.
Arrested, and she qualifies as a female. But, you know, when you go after a 70- or 80-year-old woman because her stupid grandson, you know, was hiding drugs in the house, something's wrong with that.
That's
and, you know, and it says, you know, that the problem is that in most cases, this is the girlfriend who has no knowledge or no information to exchange. Now, here's the kicker. You know, after three decades of tough-on-crime tactics, advocacy groups, legislators, and researchers have learned that these policies do little in curbing incarceration rates and have only led to prison overcrowding, with a large number of people who have committed nonviolent crimes. Mm-hmm. Since 2000, the incarceration rate for women has increased by 20%.
Ugh, that is horrible.
That is why you hear us on the radio fighting this stuff, because you know you look at these numbers and you say that in the 80s it was 13,000 women in prison and now we have 200,000 women in prison. I mean, that is an increase of, I mean, that's exponential over 20 years. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
200,000 from 13,000. It's like the prosecutors are just going after the women, seemingly.
And you know what, too? In this, it talks about, you know, even if it's her boyfriend that she maybe, you know, is an accomplice or covering or whatever, the woman usually ends up spending more time behind bars than the boyfriend does who actually committed the crime.
Yeah, yeah.
That's crazy stuff.
It's crazy. And so, you know, that's something that we need to at least share information on from time to time because of the fact that this thing does impact families in a crazy way. And, you know, with the woman being, in most cases, she's that central unit in the house. She's the glue that keeps the house together.
Exactly.
And then you yank that out. And I believe, Ethel, a couple of weeks ago, you brought up a story about how when they take a mom and put her in prison, they're trying in some places to put them at least 100 miles away from their family.
100 miles away.
That is out of control.
Claiming that it helps to ease the trauma on the children.
Exactly.
That is sick. Wow.
So our subject this evening that we're going to be focusing on quite a bit is the high rate or the increasing rate of wrongful convictions. And, you know, we know that the IRP 6 fall right in there.
That's right.
I mean, we have six men who were wrongly convicted on trumped up charges. I mean, everyone says that this case should have never gone to trial.
That's right.
You know, this is a case of an IT company, IRP Solutions Corporation, developing software for federal, state, and local law enforcement and getting accused of wrongdoing and basically even saying that the company didn't even develop software. But there's all kinds of information out there on the Internet and on our own websites to dispel that. Go to freetheirp6.org, freetheirp6.org, and follow the story. But, you know, we have sworn affidavits from folks like a retired federal agent, yeah, Gary Hilberry, who says, no, this is a legitimate company. Yes, they are developing viable software.
Yeah.
There's no reason to shut them down. The FBI raids the business anyway in February of 2005. And then, you know, it takes 8 to 9 years to go through all of this mess, and the guys get wrongly convicted in 2011 and have been sitting in Florence, Colorado, in the federal prison there for going on 20 months.
20 months for being in debt. Mm. It's ridiculous. But like I said, you know, that's why we're fighting this. That's why we're bringing it to your attention. So you can see that, you know, this system that they say, oh, it's the best system in the world,
right,
that it is beyond flawed. Like Harry Belafonte said, you know, this justice system is not working. And we'll get into some of his stuff later on. But I wanted to
set the foundation for us for tonight. Cliff.
Yeah, we have this article that came out on the 1st of October. It's by Barry Sussman. And this is in opednews.com. And the title is Recent Cases Highlight Rampant Prosecutorial Misconduct. And it states that the conviction rate in U.S. federal courts now exceeds an incredible 99%. Something more akin to what one would expect in a third world dictatorship or banana republic. The largely preordained results themselves suggest a startling level of illegitimacy. Even if every accused defendant were actually guilty, a normal margin of error would yield a conviction rate markedly lower than the patently fraudulent rate now being achieved. Justice in federal court seems to be alive and well in the world of entertainment, where various fictional legal programs rarely miss an opportunity to trump the ideals of the best system in the world, but in reality fall woefully short of these mythical representations of justice. And this article is saying just how absurd this high conviction rate is, and that if you had any type of legitimacy was to this, it would not be at 99%.
This is basically saying
you accuse people and lock them up. You accuse them and convict them. That's it. And
well, there is no trial.
Right, there's no trial. It's basically like
it's all a plea bargain.
Yeah, we think you did we think you committed a crime, so here's the amount of time you're going to spend. And just like they say in this article, it's more of a dictatorship or a banana republic in a third world country. Yeah. That how do you get a conviction rate at 99%? I mean, what else is at 99% except for, you know, 99% of the people continue to live when they breathe air? That is a statistic.
Yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, it says that the observed high conviction rate is at least partially achieved through gross federal prosecutorial misconduct. Prosecutors engaging in subornation of perjury, withholding exculpatory evidence, mm-hmm. and other various misdeeds have become so common that seasoned legal observers recognize that such practices have become standard fare in federal prosecutions. Even federal judges, largely in league with their prosecutorial counterparts, that's just a sick statement. You're in league, and of course, you know, they're in league because they basically have the same boss, the federal so-called justice system. But they've begun to weigh in with blistering criticisms of prosecutors who seek convictions at any cost. So even the judges are saying, you know what, it's time to stop. You come in, if you don't have any evidence, if you don't have something against somebody, quit just going after a conviction. And case in point, this judge and Judge Kobayashi in Hawaii, they had this case about this. They said it's the biggest crystal meth case in Hawaii's history. Mm-hmm. And they say before the case even went to the jury, it was found by the judge two of the defendants to be not guilty of all charges because of a complete lack of evidence. So here's another example of the prosecutors went out, found two people, say, hey, we're just bringing them in.
Yeah.
And this was on conspiracy. We're bringing them in just because they might know the name of somebody mm-hmm. who supposedly committed a crime. And the judge said, no, you have no evidence on these people. I'm throwing it out. And she stated the government has failed to present any admissible evidence that these two defendants were even slightly connected mm-hmm. with a conspiracy. And, I mean, it shows mm-hmm. how the prosecutors just say, I'm going after everybody with a dragnet. I'm going to bring them in, and I'm going to get them convicted because I know the judge would help me. But then, like, the sick part of this article is there's up in our wonderful favorite place of Denver, Colorado, they have this federal prosecutor. He used to be, his name is Michael Song. He used to be a federal prosecutor in Honolulu. And I'm sorry, he's not a federal prosecutor anymore. He is now a defense attorney.
Yep, mm-hmm. yep.
And they're saying that this man's dual role of defense counsel and apologist for the U.S. Attorney's Office, because every time the U.S. Attorney's Office does something wrong, he comes out, he's like their spokesman, like, you know, no, they had a reason for this, they had mm-hmm. a reason for that. They really didn't do anything wrong. And so it's saying that his dual role of defense counsel and apologist for the U.S. Attorney's Office raises serious questions about exactly who he's representing.
Yes.
Conflicted counsel like Song is another factor in the federal government's absurd 99% conviction rate, with Michael Song filling in as their de facto representative. A spokesman for the U.S. Attorney's Office in Honolulu declined to comment further on the government setback. So in Hawaii, they're saying, okay, this case, the judge is throwing this stuff out. And then they got this man,
right.
this defense counselor up in Denver, Colorado. He's saying, no, that's not really what's happened. They didn't do anything wrong. And all of this stuff. And so then the U.S. Attorney's Office in Hawaii won't even make a comment on the story. They're like, no, talk to him. He's the one, you know, he's not a part of us, but he's basically representing us. So they're getting off with absolutely nothing. And there's a lot more in that story. Maybe we can deal with it some more later, but we need to get to our
first guest.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And, you know, on today out on Huffington Post, mm-hmm. There is an article, and I think there's also a couple of you can find on a couple of other sites as well, that came out where Harry Belafonte is speaking out and basically saying that, you know, let's fix a justice system that isn't working. Mm-hmm. And it basically kind of sheds light on an ACLU program called Smart Justice, Fair Justice Campaign. And so representing ACLU this evening is Kara Dansky. And Kara is a senior counsel at the ACLU Center for Justice. And welcome to the program, Kara.
Hi,
I'm sorry, it's pronounced Kara.
Kara,
right?
Or Kara?
No, it's Kara. Thanks for asking.
Okay. All right. Excellent. Well, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us a little bit about the ACLU's Smart Justice, Fair Justice campaign.
Sure. Well, as you and your listeners know, we in America have a real problem with mass incarceration today. And we're basically dealing with a system that has been relentlessly expanding for the last 40 years, although we're starting to see some declines, which is good news. But we think that the system of mass incarceration really presents a problem of throwing people's lives away, wasting money, and being ineffective. And we think that there are better approaches to the criminal justice system. And so the Smart Justice, Fair Justice campaign explains what some of those approaches are and what we think we ought to be doing that would make the system run more effectively and more fairly.
Hey, you know, Kara, one of the things that jumped out at me in this article, it says that crime rates have been falling for the past 20 years, but still we have massive and unsustainable prison population, particularly targeting the poor and powerless. That's a powerful statement.
Well, that's right. And, you know, we got kind of stuck, really, starting in the late 1970s and 80s with an approach to criminal justice, very popularly known as the war on drugs, that got us stuck in this idea that we had to use the criminal justice system to solve some problems that are really social problems in nature. And we should be clear, we do have some problems. You know, we've got problems with poverty. We've got problems with lack of access to education, serious problems with unemployment. But we decided a couple decades ago that we were going to use the criminal justice system to basically supervise and control people, and as you say, disproportionately people of color. And even though crime rates have indeed been falling now for a couple decades, we haven't quite made it out of that system of mass incarceration or the war on drugs that got so heavily implemented in the 70s and 80s. So we're kind of still there. We're a little behind the times.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That is the understatement of the decade,
exactly.
I think. But, you know, looking at the article, when Mr. Belafonte began speaking about, you know, ending the war on drugs and how it deteriorates community by basically just throwing the masses into overcrowded jails and prisons, he makes a statement that says we spend $80 billion a year incarcerating people, which is 400% more than we spent 20 years ago. Some of the money could be better spent on raising healthy kids, not feeding a morally corrupt network that connects our children in their classrooms to the prison industrial complex. I thought that was a very, very powerful statement, because when you look at these these inner city communities, and you look at the children that, you know, it's like they're being shuffled off from public school to prison almost. And just like he states in there, with $80 billion, instead of just incarcerating people and locking them up for year upon year upon year for these nonviolent crimes,
exactly,
how about coming up with some programs to say, you know, let's teach people in these lower income or poor communities, teach them what it takes to be viable parts of society. Teach them that, you know, that they matter, that what they have, that they can offer to their community, and give more education and the proper type of education, mm-hmm, and opportunity, instead of just saying, you know, when you get out of high school, whether you graduate or drop out or whatever, if you're not going to be an athlete or an entertainer, mm-hmm, that basically you're getting shuffled off to prison, and it's atrocious.
Right. I mean, with the statement that he made really points to, I think, some real systemic problems. And I do think we need to look at this as a systemic failure. So, for example, we know that when we're dealing with disciplinary problems, young kids of color and poor kids are much more likely to suffer severe disciplinary consequences for behavior that wealthier kids and white kids don't suffer the same disciplinary consequences as poor kids of color. And kids of color end up in the juvenile system for stuff that that a lot of white kids might do and have an easier time finding alternative approaches to dealing with those kinds of problems. So I do think we need to deal with this as a systemic failure, and we need to really understand that we've really let down communities by failing to provide decent approaches, decent economic systems, decent educational systems, and lifelines to the future.
That's absolutely true. And, as you were talking about, the kids, the minorities being in prison, longer than the white kids, that is so true, because they have longer prison sentences, than white kids would normally have when they're entered into the system. And Harry Belafonte was talking about making our policies so that they are smart policies. And he was also saying that the prison does not deter crime. It actually presents more problems than it solves. And when we were talking the other day about prisons, prisoners coming out of prison, they're coming out. They may not have known how to make drugs before they went in, but they sure know, some of them sure know how to make it coming out. So it's like, they went in there, they've learned how to do stuff that is totally ridiculous when you are trying to stop a war on drugs, but they're coming out of the system knowing how to actually make drugs.
Kara, this is Sam.
Well, I think you want to ask about. Sorry.
Go ahead, Kara.
Well, I was just going to say, if you want to ask about the effectiveness of prison in dealing with some of these problems, you really only need to look at our recidivism rates. And when you realize that people are, we've got 60, sometimes 70% of people coming out of prison are going back, that really says something about how ineffective prison is. I think people also don't tend to really understand that the race disparity that we're talking about happens at every level of the criminal justice system in a way that just builds on itself. So, starting with, saturated police in communities of color, disproportionate arrest rates, disproportionate levels of charging and sentencing, and at every level of the system, it just builds on itself. So you're absolutely right to point out that people of color end up spending a lot more time in prison than white people.
Yeah.
And, Kara, I was looking at the ACLU website and looking at the page that's talking about Smart Justice, Fair Justice campaign. And you guys have a good list there of things that need to be done. And it says, end the war on drugs, make the sentence fit the crime, fight extreme sentencing, incentivize smart practices, eliminate unnecessary incarceration, invest in better systems. All of these are just common sense approaches to, fixing a problem. It's strange that we hear of all the complaints of overcrowding in prisons, and yet the prisons are understaffed, but they continue, as your article states, and as you were talking about, the increasing number of folks being sent to prison is just over the top, especially when it comes to, people of color. So, Kara, what can people do? I just read the list there, but what can people do as far as engaging with the ACLU and taking action to help to at least start fixing some of these problems? It's obviously going to, take some starting at the grassroots effort. But what are you doing from a strategy perspective within the ACLU?
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And like I said, we did get stuck in a viewpoint from several decades ago. But the good news is that we're starting to work our way out. We've got people across the political spectrum who are starting to agree that we need to find smarter and fairer approaches to dealing with criminal justice. So that's absolutely right. I really encourage folks to engage with the ACLU on our campaign for Smart Justice and Fair Justice. And also to really engage locally. I really do think that a lot of the momentum for reform is starting to come at the state and local levels, and so people can really get involved in their state politics, in city councils, get involved with advocacy with their mayors, because a lot of the demand for reform is going to come from the local level. So I'd really encourage folks to get out and get involved and come to our website and check out the 5 recommendations that we have for smarter and fairer approaches.
Excellent, excellent. Well, Kara, thank you for joining us. Kara Danske with the ACLU. You can find out more information about the Smart Justice, Fair Justice campaign to end mass incarceration at www.aclu.org, and go to the page that talks about Smart Justice, Fair Justice. Again, Kara, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman with Cliff Stewart and Ethel Lopez. Welcome to the program. You know, Kara Danske from the ACLU was talking about the program there at the ACLU, the Smart Justice, Fair Justice campaign. You know, folks need to go out there and check it out. And you know, one of the things that she said in her closing comments there was get involved.
That's it. That's
you
what
know,
it takes.
Get mm-hmm. involved. And that's, you know, we organizations like a Just Cause, ACLU, Innocence Project,
yeah.
Sentencing Project, you know, the list just goes on and on and on. Get involved. You know, we are offering an opportunity, folks, to get involved right here on a Just Cause. You know, you can contact us at like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Our subject this evening, we're talking about the high rate or the rather the increasing rate of wrongful convictions. Mm-hmm. Joining us now on the phones, Maurice Posley. Maurice is the 2008 Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, and he's authored several books. He has over 30 years of experience as a journalist and a writer. He's been with the Tribune. He's done a lot of things, and he is currently engaged in doing investigations on wrongful convictions and prosecutorial misconduct and criminal justice issues. And so, you know, it's good to have you on the program, Maurice. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So give us a little bit of, about your background, and then let's talk about this problem that's in this country with wrongful convictions and prosecutorial misconduct. Cliff was talking about it a little bit before the break. You know, you heard the clip there just a minute ago after we talked to Kara from the ACLU and Harry Belafonte clip that we had. You know, it's a major problem. So tell us about yourself, Maurice, and then some of the things that you're doing in this regard.
Well, I worked as a journalist primarily in Chicago for more than three decades. And the latter part of my career was focused on the criminal justice system. In Chicago and nationally, and we looked at individual cases of wrongful conviction where we reinvestigated cases and also systemic problems. And one of the first series of articles we did on the issue of prosecutorial misconduct, which was really the first time that anyone had tried to do sort of a systemic investigation of it. We looked at 25 years, we looked at 35 years of Brady violations, which are cases where the prosecution fails to turn over evidence that tends to show the innocence of a defendant. And then we focused also on Chicago. And that led us to do subsequent investigations of things like false confessions, the death penalty in Illinois, the death penalty in Texas. And so after I left the Tribune in 2008, I worked in California on a project on the issue of prosecutorial misconduct in the state of California. So it is an issue that I've done some work on, and I've also done work on wrongful convictions of individual people. Right now, I'm working with the National Registry of Exoneration. It is an online database of wrongful convictions since 1989 in the United States. The current total is 1,325. This is a joint research project of Michigan Law School and Northwestern University's Center on Wrongful Convictions. It continues to grow as we continue to add cases and we study causes of wrongful conviction. And each case gets its own sort of narrative, story of the crime, how the individual or individuals came to be arrested, convicted, and how the case they came to be exonerated. So that's probably longer than you needed, but it's essentially what sort of the arc.
No, that's the kind of information we need to share with our listeners because
yeah,
you know we. You know, when you talk about the National Registry of Exonerations and the work that they're doing there, you know, that in and of itself, that list shows how much of a problem there is with with the exonerations or with the wrongful convictions, I should say. And you know, it's all over the place. You know, I'm looking at the list right now, California, Texas. It's just all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
well,
we actually,
the more we look, the more we find. This grew out of a couple of things. One was an article that Sam Gross, a law professor at Michigan, wrote and published. He's done scholarly research over the years on the issue of wrongful convictions. And this is 2003, it was published, I believe, where he said, we don't really know how many wrongful convictions there are because there is no registry that collects this data. You can go to the courthouse and look up criminal cases, but there's no central place in this country to say, how do we find out about people who were wrongly convicted? The Innocence Project in New York, which does only DNA, has maintained a list, but it's only DNA cases. And so the thing is, Rob Warden, who's the director of the Northwestern Center on Wrongful Convictions, had this idea to write a book called The Encyclopedia of Exonerations, and quickly realized that the day it came off the printing press, it was going to be out of date. It was a snapshot in time.
Yeah.
And so the idea is to put it online and continue to add cases, not only as they happen in real time, but as we find them in the past, through various, you know, sort of digging efforts through different legal and media databases. And like I said, the more we look, the more we find. We issued our annual report in February for the year 2013, and it listed 87 exonerations in that year, and it's the highest total that we've been recorded in any year in the 25 years that the registry covers. Now, we've since added a case that we didn't know about, so it's now 88. And so the point what I'm making is we've really only, the registry went online in May of 2012. So we're coming up on 2 years here. At that point, there were 891 cases. Now there's 1,325. Two-thirds of those are cases that happened in the past that we didn't know about. You know, there's 3,300 counties in the United States, and I think the registry has exonerations in about 400. Now, a lot of these counties have, you know, 12 people, but you can't tell me that there aren't a lot more that we don't know about that we haven't found out about yet. So to answer the question, how many are there? We don't know. What we do know is that with 1,325, on average, for 25 years, once a week in the United States, someone has been exonerated of a crime they did not commit.
And you know, Maurice, one of the stats that jump out to me from that list also, and it's shocking, and it makes you also wonder and have great concern for death row inmates. And you know, I know the registry talks, at least one of the stats that I'm looking at here says that there have been 101 death row inmates freed. And you know, when you read something like that, and that comes from, I think Sam Gross was doing an interview with Huffington Post. But when you read something like that and you think 101 death row inmates freed and exonerated, how many folks were wrongly executed? And, you know, that kind of thing is troubling.
Right, because that's almost 10%
mm-hmm.
Of the recorded or tracked, you know, of that 13% number, I mean, that 1,300 and something out exonerations that you talk about, Maurice, 10% of those are death row. And these are people that were slated to be, you know, executed mm-hmm. and actually murdered because they actually never did anything wrong. 10%, and when you look at it from, you know, 10% of the life, and, you know, as the number grows, you know, and we're glad that it's growing, but that is a real eye opener right there. Yeah. And to, like Sam said, you know, how many people that were innocent actually got put to death for something mm-hmm. they never did and went to the grave crying out saying, I'm innocent?
Well, we don't know the answer to that question.
Right.
Well,
no,
I
don't.
I was at the Tribune. We did. We looked at a couple of cases where I think we, and we wrote about them, that I think we came up with fairly compelling evidence that, in fact, that's exactly what happened. One is the Cameron Todd Willingham case out of Texas, where he was executed for setting a fire that killed his three young babies.
And, right. Yeah, we just talked about that case on Tuesday evening, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
We were the ones that broke that story back in 2004. And then we also wrote about a young fellow named Carlos de Luna out of Corpus Christi, and where we actually identified the real killer. Of course, it doesn't bring Carlos de Luna back to life. We don't know how many. Hopefully, we hope that it's not many people that have wrongly executed. One of the reasons that you'd see a number that high in terms of exonerations is because with a threat of death, they're bound to get more attention.
Right.
From people who work on these cases. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, that's understandable, because there's a certain deadline here that's pretty final, which is you stop breathing. So the question is it any worse than other crimes? And you know, I don't know that it isn't. I think it could be just as bad. In other crimes, it just doesn't get the attention. You know, innocence projects in this country are overwhelmed. And they're underfunded, and they rely on a lot of pro bono work done by law firms, private law firms, free. but a lot of them won't even accept a case, won't even open up a file in a case unless there's 7 or 8 or 10 years left on that person's sentence, because it's a triage sort of situation where you work on the cases where people, first of all, face death, and then second of all, who have the most onerous sentences. Because, you know, if you get somebody who's in there for 2 years, it might take you 5 years before you even develop the evidence.
Right.
Meanwhile, the person's out. So the idea is, let's work on the cases of the people who are suffering the worst first.
Right.
And, you know, even those, you know, they're backlogged.
Right. So, Maurice, a question for you. In reference to getting the stories out there, you being an investigative journalist, a writer, what have you, my question is, when I've talked to a lot of different journalists about the IRP 6 case and trying to get that out there, and I'm kind of moving away from a little bit of what you were talking about just then, but to get their story picked up, you hear this stuff about it's not sexy enough and this kind of thing. But when you've got 6 families that are being destroyed, why is it so hard to get attention drawn to such cases?
Well, it's hard to say, because each one sort of depends upon the media market that they're in. It depends upon how compelling the evidence of actual innocence it is, and how and there's a number of factors that go into it. What I can tell you is there's also a fatigue factor that relates even to exonerations. You know, you know, I remember once coming up to an editor and saying that I had a story about an exoneration that was happening, and the editor said, well, haven't we done that story before? And I said, well, it's a different person. And so, you know, the fact is that some people view it as, well, it's just another case, and other people have the ability to say, well, this is an individual case. And so look at it as an individual case and not as, well, this is something we've done before. You know, we did this trend a while ago about people being wrongfully convicted. And it's hard to get, sometimes it's hard to get people to focus on an individual case unless it's really, really obvious.
Maury's on the.
Wasn't me. It wasn't the guy. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, you know, that's kind of weird. On when an editor takes that type of approach on something, and you know, often we talk about, well, they take an attitude that, well, and not just editors, but people in general, mm-hmm. it's as if, well, it's not happening to me, so it's not a problem, and so you know, when you mention the fact that an editor or an assignment editor or you know, whomever, if it's in print or if it's on over the air, it's like if they looked at other news that same way, you know, we wouldn't hear about the automobile accident. It would be like, oh, well, no, we're not going to report on that. We've already talked about an automobile accident.
Exactly.
Well, we already talked about it snowed last week.
Right.
You know, when it's a major problem like this, it needs to have everyone get involved, and I'm looking at this another one of the things here too that from the registry's perspective is the fact that you know you guys looked at a lot of the concentration of the cases are right there from Cook County in Chicago, you know, and so when you look at a major metropolitan area like Chicago and the high number of exonerations there, man, if you look at the entire nation, I mean, it's got to be exponentially just...
Oh, yeah.
It's got to be through the roof.
No doubt. And you know, Maurice, we were talking about an article earlier that was saying recent cases highlight rampant prosecutorial misconduct. And you were speaking about the causes of wrongful convictions. And in this article, it was a some prosecutorial misconduct going on in Hawaii. This article states that while federal prosecutors in Hawaii were caught committing flagrant prosecutorial abuses, facts were coming to light regarding their counterparts in New York. So it shows it's a systemic problem. On February 18, 2014, Second Circuit Federal Court of Appeals, Tyrone Gilliams filed a motion revealing that an affidavit hidden from the defense by federal prosecutor assistant U.S. Attorney David Massey clearly shows his innocence. The affidavit demonstrates that Gilliams, a prominent Philadelphia-based entrepreneur, philanthropist, and event promoter, did not devise a scheme to defraud investors for which he was sentenced to 10 years in prison last fall. And looking at this, you know, it kind of goes in line with this with the IRP 6 case that A Just Cause is working on and really pushing, because they were accused. Falsely accused, falsely convicted, and falsely imprisoned about, you know, devising a scheme to defraud staffing companies that they were in business with. And as we, as A Just Cause, look into this case, we see that the prosecutor, Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch, the court reporter has withheld 200 pages of court transcript.
Over
200 pages mm-hmm. of court transcript from this trial. And the judge, Judge Christine Arguello, is not pushing the court reporter to deliver those 200 pages, over 200 pages of court transcript. And the reason is that in those pages, the defense is saying that the judge compelled them, which, you know, in layman's terms is forced one of them to take the stand under the threat that if you do not, I will close your case for you. Mm-hmm. And so you have this going on where the prosecutor withheld exculpatory evidence in this case. The judge is holding part of the transcript. The court reporter is in line with that. And we as A Just Cause have actually had to sue them. We've got Mark Garagos working on it to say, hey, where is the transcript for this case? And Mark Garagos said in his 31 years of practice, he's never seen anything like this. And so from your perspective, doing these looking at these wrongful convictions and causes, what, if you can tell us, is the percentage or the time that you guys look at it and say, hey, this is just prosecutorial misconduct, that the judge is not basically doing their job as a referee, and it's things that's going on in the judicial process instead of a, you know, like with the Innocence Project, like missing DNA or something like that, where they can't really make a decision yet?
Well, I can't speak to the to your case that you're championing.
Right, right.
But, what I can tell you is that, you know, when we look at these cases, what we try to do is assign, based on our analysis, one of several potential causes of wrongful conviction. And cases can have more than one.
Right.
And it breaks down into what we call perjury or false accusation, mm-hmm. official misconduct, which includes misconduct that you're talking about when you say prosecutor misconduct, and that includes things like withholding exculpatory evidence, evidence that tends to show a defendant is innocent. It also includes police corruption or police misconduct, coercing false confessions from people. We have mistaken witness identification, bad forensics, which is bad forensics or good forensics practiced badly. False confessions, and basically poor defense work. The number one, the most frequent cause that we find is perjury or false accusation, which surprises some people. But 20% of the cases, approximately, a little bit more than 20% of the 1,300, are no crime cases. There was no crime.
Wow.
And that's because people were falsely accused of crimes that just never happened. The single 50% of those are sex abuse cases, where it's a false accuser, either a child put up in a bad custody or divorce situation, or a person who's upset at someone and makes a false accusation of sexual assault. The second number, that's 56% of the cases involve perjury or false accusation. 46% is official misconduct. That's, you know, about one out of two cases of wrongful conviction involves some official misconduct by a prosecutor or a police officer, or if it's a federal case, maybe an FBI agent or some sort of federal agent. That's one out of two. I think that the issue of prosecutorial misconduct is getting a lot more traction in this country, sort of in the public discussion, in part because there have been some high-profile cases, they've happened in white-collar cases as well as non-white-collar cases, you know, violent crime. And it's the white-collar cases that people, people of influence start to feel like, well, maybe that could happen to me. You know, that's always been one of the issues for people who say, well, you know, there, but that's how they define themselves, by saying, those people over there, I would never do anything like that, and that could never happen to me. And then, you know, you see people say, well, how could someone falsely confess? And then you see it happen. So I think that because of some of these cases, there's a recent website that's been set up, Center for Prosecutorial Integrity, that's going to try and track cases of specifically of prosecutorial misconduct. You know, when we did the study in California, we found more than 700 cases. And it's, people are upset because prosecutors don't get punished. They don't get, they get caught doing things that they're not supposed to. There are no consequences. The cases get reversed, and sometimes they involve innocent people, and sometimes they involve guilty people that go free because of. I think people are getting tired of it.
Yeah, we agree 100%. Joining us this evening, Maurice Posley, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist and author. Writes about wrongful convictions, prosecutorial misconduct, and just criminal justice issues in general. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast. We're going to share a little bit more. Maurice is going to share a little bit more with us on the other side of the break. We got some folks waiting in the queue, have some questions and comments from callers. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. We'll be right back in a moment. Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman with Cliff Stewart and Ethel Lopez. Joining us this evening on the phone is Maurice Posley, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author, formerly was with the Chicago Tribune, and is now working with the registry, the National Registry of Exonerations. Mm-hmm. So, again, welcome to the program, Maurice. We have a caller in the queue. Cliff, who do we have?
We have Tom. Tom, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
You have a question or a comment for our guest?
I do. Thank you. my name is Tom Evans, and I was wrongfully convicted of rape in Minnesota back in 1999. And as your guests have correctly talked about, I had virtually the perfect storm on these different reasons why people get wrongfully convicted. I had poor lawyering from my defense lawyer, Fred Getz. Brady violation was present. And then perjury is really a huge problem as well in my case. And so I'm really grateful to your program. I'm so happy to have found it tonight online on Twitter. And it gives people a lot of hope, because if somebody could look into my case, what you'll find is that I'm innocent and that my life has been largely destroyed even since I've been out from behind bars in the community for the last 5 years. And if I could get a little bit of help, I could really help a lot of people, because I'm very passionate about trying to pay things forward.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. So, Tom, I take it that you're still going to going through the appellate process and trying to clear your name. Is that am I understanding that correctly?
Close. I went through the entire appellate process either with largely by myself, because quite frankly they don't either give you lawyers, or if they do, the lawyers are incompetent and then you have to file your own brief. So here's what has happened quickly. I have exhausted all of my appeals. I took everything up in front of, in fact, United States Judge Donovan Frank, who is looking at the Minnesota sex offender case now, and punted it back to the Minnesota legislature. So Judge Frank had a clear showing in front of him of an innocent individual. There was nothing ambiguous about it. All of the appellate courts are all broken in Minnesota, and what they do is, if you're a sex offender, even if you're innocent, and you show them Brady violations, and you show them black and white that you're innocent, it doesn't matter. The Constitution does not matter. If you're labeled as a sex offender and you get convicted, so what I'm still trying to do, though, is always fighting. I'm innocent. And again, my life has been destroyed out here. I can't have a date. I can't get married. I certainly can't have children. So I can't even earn money. And I have a billion-dollar deal in the queue. If you go to www.sportsboxers.com, and then go to the medical brand, www.supportboxers.com. I have a medical underwear that's invented by this so-called sex offender that could be helping millions of men right now in this country. And I've met with 50 people in the Twin Cities. Every one of them opened up their checkbook. And then I told them, oh, gee, I don't want you to Google me. Do you realize I'm a falsely convicted rapist? No, we didn't know that. Then they close their checkbooks and they leave, even though they love me. So I'm innocent. I need help. I have an attorney named Peter Erlander that you all probably know. Peter's extremely busy trying to save Africa and dealing with his PTSD, and I'm dealing with my PTSD from the system. And I am reaching out and I'm begging you to please help me. 15 years ago, I contacted Barry Check, and I contacted Peter Neufeld, and they told me correctly that they cannot help me. They have people on death row, Tom. And I said, I understand that. What can I do? And they told me, you get an innocence project going in Minnesota. So what did I do? I called Chicago, and I talked to David Protest and Larry Marshall, and then I called up and I talked to Wendy Frey in Wisconsin, then I talked to Jackie McMurtry in Washington, and my dad and I, we went blood, sweat, and tears to Hamlin, William Mitchell and the University of Minnesota, the three Minnesota law schools here. And then lo and behold, from the ashes, they built the Minnesota Innocence Project. And please understand this. Julie Jonas is the managing attorney. Erica Applebaum was appointed as the executive director in this whitewashed one that I created. And what they did is they found two people. One of them stepped on the gas pedal too hard or something. Not one sex offender have they found in 10 years. There are thousands of us that are in Minnesota that have been labeled as rapists and child molesters. And because they've been bought off by the powers that be in this state, the corrupt judges, the corrupt district attorneys, the corrupt cops, because of all of this, Erica Applebaum and this other woman make $50,000 each with no one that they can find in their microscope that's innocent. And they've never been willing to meet with me since I created their organization. So I am crying out tonight, but I'm also very respectful and I'm humble. So I'm going to get off the line and let other people call in because other people have problems as well. I'd like to leave you, please, with my Twitter handle, which tells you everything you'll need to know. And I'm right here. My Twitter handle is my name. It is at Tom Evenstad, T-O-M-E-V-E-N-S-T-A-D. I'm Twitter at Tom Evenstad. And then one website, I have 20 of these. One of them is all you need to get looking at what happened to me, and it's the cop. I have one for the prosecutor, and I have one for the judge. But the police officer, it's
hey,
www.
Hey, Tom.
Okay,
Tom.
One
Tom.
Website.
Tom, let me jump in there. Tom, let me jump in there.
Okay.
What I'll ask you to do is if you would, and man, you have a serious story going on there.
Yeah.
So let me ask you to do this. If you're in front of your computer, go ahead and load that information into your contact information. Go ahead and put it in the chat room.
Mm-hmm.
And then what we'll do, we have like 30 volunteers, and we'll help get your contact information out there. And then folks can reach out to you and help to, you know, possibly get some traction on your case. I mean, because it's about, like you were saying, you know, getting the word out. And if you feel as though no one is listening to you,
mm-hmm.
Which we have been there,
yeah.
Believe me, we have been there, as Ethel was talking about before.
Yeah.
So,
oh, yeah.
So Maurice, when you hear a story like Tom's, I'm sure you've seen and heard stories and cases like this before. What kind of, you know, from a journalist perspective, you know, I understand you're not an attorney,
right.
and just like at the top of our show, we give a disclaimer. We're not attorneys. We don't give legal advice. You know, we'll try and help people to get their word out there. But what can you say to Tom?
Well, all I can say really is that I'm sympathetic to people who believe that they have the evidence that shows that they're wrongly convicted and they can't get a court to accept that. And, you know, some of the stories in the registry are right on point with people who fought for years and years and years, and judge after judge and court after court basically stuck it down their throats until, you know, finally they prevailed. It's you know, once you're convicted, it becomes so exponentially more difficult to undo things because of the way the system is set up. The facts don't matter anymore. They do, but I mean, procedurally, for a long time, it has to go in the law. And then, you know, in terms of new evidence, and I can't go into all the different sort of legal schemes that are involved, and I don't mean that in a pejorative way, but just the way the system is set up
right.
In terms of bringing in new evidence. But I mean, you know, there are court cases that basically say that, you know, evidence of innocence is not necessarily a grounds for setting aside a conviction, which, you know, just seems ridiculous on its face. It is very difficult. And, you know, my guess is, I can't even guess as to how many people who are wrongly convicted never get their convictions undone.
Yeah.
Just no way to know that. You know, one of the things that we see is sort of, in a weird way, it's a positive thing that we see it as. That is, the number of people who plead guilty, who are exonerated, that number is going up. What that tells us is that prosecutors and judges are becoming more willing to accept the fact that people can plead guilty to something that they did not do because of all the pressures that go on. You know, that there is a tax if you go to trial, and you can plead guilty and now and get 10 years and go to trial and you're going to get 50. And that people do plead, it's the same thing with false confessions. You know, it took a while, and it's still extremely difficult in both these situations to undo it once it's happened. But we do sort of see, based on the cases we found, that there seems to be more of a willingness to at least listen. The fact is that, you know, DNA, the registry chronicles cases from 1989 forward, and 1989 was selected because that's the year of the first DNA exoneration in the United States. So it seemed like a good sort of starting point to go work forward from, because, you know, DNA has proved to be sort of the truth serum for the criminal justice system. It's, you know, provided this window that shows all the things that go wrong and reasons that cases people get wrongly convicted, all the reasons that I talked about before. And what you see is that of the 1,300 plus cases in the registry, 367, 28% are DNA cases, which means 72% are non-DNA cases. And, you know, it's more difficult. DNA is, you know, it's the gold standard. You bring in the DNA, and you say, okay, I got the DNA, shows it's not me, and in fact, here's who it really is. That's pretty convincing. But, you know, 72% of the cases that we've... And that shows, I think, that the system... is a little bit more willing to look at these cases, and I think DNA has emboldened people, and by that people I mean prosecutors and judges, emboldened them to say, okay, I should take a look at this, or I'm willing to take a look at it, and to actually say, okay, I believe you.
And Maurice, you know, you had spoken about 46% of the exonerations that you guys deal with have been from official misconduct. And I'm looking at an article here that says, in May of last year, the New York Times editorialized that it might seem obvious that prosecutors with any sense of fairness would inform a defendant's lawyer of evidence that could be favorable to the defendant's case. But in fact, this principle, known as the Brady Rule, has been restricted by subsequent rulings of the court and has been severely weakened by a near complete lack of punishment for prosecutors who flout the rule. So basically what you're looking at is that, and like you say, you know, for more exonerations to be happening outside of DNA cases, that, you know, on some level the court has to be willing to look at these cases. Mm-hmm. But in that article where it says, you know, it seems like it would be obvious that they would bring forth evidence that they wouldn't break these rules, but the fact that they are not held accountable, that there's no, you know, they really get immunity for when they do these things. They, you know, they might get a slap on the wrist if they're found to be, you know, blatantly going outside of the law and committing these crimes. And I think that is what is atrocious. And like you say, you know, outside of the, what did you say, 18% or 28% of the DNA cases, you have all these other ones that something else happened, and the prosecutors need to be held accountable, judges need to be held accountable, mm-hmm. and they need to dig into mm-hmm. these reasons instead of, you know, trying to get a conviction at any cost and waiting for a person to go through 10, 20, 30 years of their life behind bars before they give them a chance at you know, getting somebody to hear their case.
Right.
I you know, the fact is they get the right guy, the right person most of the time. If that weren't the case, we would, you know, it'd be chaos. And I don't think that prosecutors walk into a courtroom saying, today I'm going to convict an innocent person. I think they've convinced themselves that the person is guilty, and they're aided in that by whatever investigative agency brings them the case, whether it's the FBI, the IRS, the local police, you know, the sheriff, the county sheriff's office, whomever brings that in. And you get into the situation where, you know, okay, now they're trying to decide what evidence they're supposed to turn over, they should turn over. And I think they look at some of this as it's a red herring, it's just a distraction. Well, you know, your red herring, your distraction is another man's proof of his innocence.
Right, and his freedom.
And, you know, the fact is that there has to be a change in culture. And bringing that about is going to require a number of things, and one is accountability, and another is that the citizens, people, have to decide what they're willing to tolerate and not tolerate. You know, is the checkbook, you pay enough millions of dollars in compensation or in damages based on misconduct of police. Like you said, prosecutors are immune except in extraordinarily narrow circumstances. And that's a whole other issue. You know, people say there's the argument that prosecutors need to be immune to be able to do their job free from vexatious lawsuits. And it's sort of like, well, doctors don't have that immunity. Lawyers, defense lawyers don't have that immunity. The immunity protects the unethical prosecutor. The ethical prosecutor doesn't need it. I think that people are getting more upset. I'm not sure that's the right word, but there's certainly, I think, there's a growing, I think, sense of resentment in this country that we're using the criminal justice system to solve our social problems. And the result has been, as you talked about this earlier, we're funneling people at a rate higher than anywhere else in the world into prisons.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So at some point, will we get to, you know, I'm mad as hell and I won't take it anymore? I don't know. But I think that there certainly is a growing undercurrent in this country of people saying this is not right.
Definitely. So, I mean, and basically,
what happens, you know, like, I mean, one of the things that I think the registry can do is provide data in this sort of discussion that has not been available before. And, you know, the more data we collect, I think the more valuable it is, because no one's done this before in any sort of systemic way.
Right. We have a caller on. Gina, you have a question or comment for Maurice? Gina, are you there? All
yes.
Right. Oh, there
okay.
You are.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we
this
hear
is
you.
Yes. I have a question and a comment. Maurice just mentioned that we have to get fed up with this kind of thing that's going on. I'm already there. And I think there's a lot of people who feel that this has got to stop. It makes no sense for someone to serve 30 years of their life when at the beginning they had proof that they were innocent. And I want to ask the question, and I just want your comments on whatever happened to the concept of innocent until proven guilty. It sounds like to me that the court system is wrapped up in trying to say you're guilty and you better come in and fight with everything you've got within you to say that you didn't do something, when I thought the whole justice system was set up on the fact that you are innocent until proven guilty. and it just doesn't feel like it's that way. And I want to restate that I think I'm not the only one. There are many people across this country that are fed up with this. We're at the point of we're tired of people's lives being destroyed because no one is paying attention to the truth. And the truth is not corrupt. The truth is the truth. It's not a concept. It's not a precept. It's what people are saying is. And prosecutors and judges need to start listening to the truth.
Okay. Thank you for your comment.
And your question.
And Maurice, if you want to go ahead and answer that, we have a couple other callers in. So if you want to answer that real quick before we go to break.
That's a question to answer in the sense of, you know, that concept is still there. It's just, you know, we see these different factors come into play in some of these cases. That, first of all, it's a human system. But I don't think every mistake is intentional. And sometimes once the ball gets rolling, it's very difficult to stop. I think, you know, people say, you know, how would you fix the system? Well, if I had a magic wand, I'd give every defendant the same opportunity to defend himself that the richest person has. I think that it's largely a question of economics, much as anything, and that the poor get the shaft. I think that there's an incredible number of public defenders out there who do amazing work. They're overburdened. They're understaffed. I think the whole quality of indigent defense in this country is... and that's the way I would fix it. I don't have that magic.
Yeah. Joining us this evening, Maurice Posley, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author. And our phone number this evening, 347-838-8976. You know, one of the things that, and Maurice will be back after this break, but and I'll hold my comment until after that break. This is A Just Cause, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. We'll be right back. A Just Cause, Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. That's Dallas Burgess with the IRP 6 Anthem. Joining us this evening, Maurice Posley, Pulitzer Prize winner, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist and author. And you know, one of the things you mentioned a couple of times, Maurice, when you talk about intentional acts on the part of prosecutors and court officials and so forth and so on, you know, and you know, even just looking at, I mean, I think most of the websites dedicated to this type of advocacy address some of the issues of the misconduct. And on the Center for Wrongful Convictions, it even says, you know, that police, prosecutors, or other government officials significantly abuse their authority or judicial process in a manner that contributed to the exoneree's conviction. And so, you know, when I read something like that, in situations like that, oh, it's intentional. and I think that in some cases, and I understand what you're saying from a standpoint that not everyone does it, but when they do that, man, they take it all the way to the hilt. And when you're talking about false confessions, and we've heard many, many stories from exonerees who spent, you know, 15, 18, 20 years in prison after a coerced confession. And I think in that case, you know, in those types of cases, you definitely had police officers, detectives, investigators, whatever, who deliberately did something. And then you talk about false forensics evidence and so forth. So, you know, and we have a term here, Maurice, where we say, you know, we're not going to throw the baby out with the bathwater. So, but when those who do engage in this activity, I don't want to give them an out and say it wasn't intentional. I want to say no. They deliberately did something. But like you said, not all of them out there are fall into that category. But those that do, we got to call it what it is. Right. We got another caller, Maurice. Let's go to the phones.
Okay, on the phones, we have Rose. You have a question or comment for our guest?
Yes, I do. I was thinking as I listened to Maurice and talking about the different things that's wrong with our justice system, and I'm a firm believer until we get to the root cause of what's producing all of this, it'll always keep producing it. And so as I think about that, I'm thinking if without accountability, we will always have a certain amount of corrupt judges and prosecutors doing what they want to do, because without a doubt, unless we hold ourselves accountable, our children accountable, or people as a whole, if they're not held accountable for their actions, they'll just continue that. So, for us, I'm thinking tonight, if our laws that we have in place that controls us when we drive down the street and we have a red light we're supposed to stop, and if we don't, we have consequences for it. So everything in our society has something to do with if you break the law, there are consequences for it. That same rule should apply to prosecutors and judges. Yep. And as long as we let anybody off the hook, we're always going to have corruption in this system. And so it's really not a justice system, not at all. It is a system, but it has nothing to do with justice. And Jerry Spence, a well-known a criminal defense attorney, and I quote him, and he said, there is no such thing as justice. He said, you buy your justice. And we know that justice that can be purchased is not justice. So that's why we have the people who are very wealthy or whatever, they constantly get off the hook. But all of the prosecutorial misconduct is not aimed at the rich. It's aimed at the people that cannot fight them. It's toward those people, those minorities and African Americans in this country. They aim it toward them because many of them are not economically in a position in which to defend themselves. They can't afford the attorney who can help them with it. So we've got these judges and prosecutors sitting in courtrooms, and as one of them said to my daughter, who was wrongly convicted, I have your life in my hand. Hey, I think not. And as long as you think that you can control my life and my destiny, and you can do what you want without any recourse, without any accountability, why should you stop? We don't even allow it in our own homes with our kids. We set rules, and if you break those rules, you're held accountable for that. So, and if you don't have any consequences for it, you're going to steal cookies out the cookie jar non-stop. But if I say, if you take that cookie, I'm going to discipline you, then you're going to think a couple of times before you do it. So I think the root cause of our system as it is today comes from the fact that we have given too much power to prosecutors and judges and said, you can do whatever you want to do. Nobody's going to bother you. There are no consequences. So if you want to send people to jail for 30 years, go ahead. Change that for a moment. Change it and say, if you rightfully know, if you have evidence that will vindicate a person and you withhold that evidence, you're going to jail for 30 years too. I will guarantee you this whole system will take a turn like we've never seen. We kind of want to kind of cut off the top of the plant, but until you get the root of the thing, it's going to keep producing, and that's what's happening in this country. Our system is not going to get any better as long as we support the people who put innocent people in prison. That's why we've got overcrowding. If some of these judges and prosecutors would have to answer and say, okay, did you have the evidence? Did you allow it in the court? Did you present it to the jury? If you didn't, you're going to prison. I guarantee you. And not only are you going to prison, you're going to solitary confinement. We see a drastic change in this country, and we wouldn't have to run around and say, well, our system is faulty. We don't know exactly what's wrong. What's wrong? No accountability. And thank you for this time.
Well, thank you. And so, Maurice, when you look at, the whole thing, you have the different reasons that people get convicted while there's evidence of their innocence on the table. You have prosecutorial misconduct. You have false confessions. You have, you know, people who said that they saw something. And like you said earlier, you know, mm-hmm. no crime ever was committed, but we got a conviction. And, you know, as you hear from the callers, there's a sect. There is a mass of people who understand that this systemic problem needs to be dealt with, and it starts in the courtroom. I mean, I believe that is exactly where it starts, in the courtroom. If the judges do what's right, if they just play referee and don't allow prosecutors to get away with their misconduct, and when they find it, like the caller Rose said, if we hold their feet to the fire mm-hmm. and say, you are accountable if you break the law, you withhold evidence, you coerce a witness to confess falsely, then you're held accountable and you're going to go to prison. I think we will see some drastic changes in this issue that we're looking at with
That's
these wrongful
true.
Convictions.
That is true.
And Maurice, we do have another caller. Let's get him in because we know that your time is running out. So we want to get this other caller really quick, and then we'll let you respond. Lamont, we have you on the phone. You have a question or a comment for Maurice?
Yes, I do. Good evening, gentlemen. Good to call in. I'll be brief as possible here. I want to basically piggyback on the comments of Rose, of what she just said. You know, I'm going to be honest with you, gentlemen, tonight. I sit here tonight sickened and nauseated of what I have heard tonight. The young man calling with the sex offender situation, pleading for help. It is the most tragic thing. As I sit here week after week and listen to the insanity of this country, of this system, as Rose put it, that we have the nerve to put the word justice on it. It is a disgrace, and I talk from personal experience. I was wrongfully convicted, sent to prison for something I didn't do, and I go back to the point that was made in regards to the intent of a prosecutor. We are held accountable as citizens if we premeditate an act that commits a crime. We are, as a matter of fact, the penalty is worse for those that have set out and planned and premeditated and thoughtfully sought out a way to commit a crime. What baffles my mind above anything that I've heard on this show tonight in this country is that if our president of the United States, who holds the most powerful office in this country, is not above the law, he is not supposed to be. And you have a Congress and you have a Senate that have the power to impeach a president based upon criminal acts that violated the Constitution. Can someone please explain to me how a judge or a DA can be above the law and not held accountable? That is the most contradictory piece of garbage that I have ever seen in this system. So if the president is accountable, if Congress has the power to remove an acting president from office upon acts that he may or may not that he may commit, can somebody please help me understand how we have come to a point to justify that a judge or a DA has immunity to break the law? That is the most ridiculous thing I have ever heard, and I can never, ever seem to get my hands around. But you know why you can't get your hands around it? Because it makes absolutely no sense. So I'm grateful for Just Cause. I'm grateful for your guests tonight. I mean, we have to keep fighting and pushing and making the voice of those that cannot speak heard. Because I'm going to tell you, when in my particular case, when evidence was presented clearly to the prosecutor by witnesses that said they lied, witnesses that said they were told to lie, witnesses that said it was insane that they were pressured to do this and to do that, not only by the alleged victim, but also the prosecutor. And they continue to pursue to convict me regardless of that? Oh, it's with an intent, and there has to be a penalty for that. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for the call. Maurice, so you get the last word on this segment, and then we're going to have to roll to another segment, but you got them lined up in the queue. We're going to have you back, man. You got a lot of a good conversation going here. So joining us this evening, Maurice Posley, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author. So, Maurice, how can folks get in contact with you? What are some of the things you're working on? We know that you're with the National Registry of Exonerations right now, previously with the Chicago Tribune. But, you know, make a couple of comments based on the last couple of callers, and we're going to have you back.
Well, let me say, people want to reach me. The easiest way is to go right through the registry's website. There is a thing where you can email the registry directly, and it all comes to me. And so I'll see those. In terms of the callers, you know, I said this before, and accountability is huge. There are things in place. The problem is that they aren't enforced.
Right.
Prosecutors have immunity from civil lawsuits, the same way with judges. But there are disciplinary agencies that can do things, but they don't do anything. We saw the extremely rare instance in the Michael Morton case in Texas where the prosecutor who withheld the evidence that showed that Michael Morton was innocent and pointed to another person, and that person who actually went on to kill someone else as well as Morton's wife. Morton did 25 years before DNA testing showed that he was innocent and identified the real killer. And that prosecutor became a judge, as many of them do, was charged with a crime for withholding this this evidence. And he pled guilty, and he lost his judgeship, and he lost his law license. And he served, I think, less than 72 hours before they let him out. So, you know, you can contrast 72 hours versus 25 years all you want and see the inequity there. But the fact is that this actually happened, and it happened in Texas, which to me is part of this, what I was talking about before, is that people are getting more fed up with it, and they are going to start doing things about it. There are things in place that can make things as people be accountable. They just have to take up the cudgel and do something about it. So anybody who was listening who believes that they would qualify for the registry, send us an email through the registry, and we'll take a look at the cases and see if they... we've added a number of cases by people who have emailed us and said, look at my case, and we don't investigate the cases. We look and see if they qualify for the registry. And, you know, thank you for having me on. I'll answer people's questions through the registry anytime.
Awesome.
Thanks.
Maurice Posley of the National Registry of Exonerations. Maurice is a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist and author. We appreciate the time, Maurice, and, we appreciate you sharing your thoughts and ideas. Maurice has written several books, and obviously there's a lot of writings out there by Maurice. So, again, thanks, Maurice Posley. All right, let's move on to our exoneration moment. Alan Newton is going to join us now. Alan, are you there? Thanks for holding on. We really appreciate you joining the program. This is Sam Thurman along with Cliff Stewart and Ethel Lopez. How you doing, Alan?
I'm okay, Sam. Thank you for having me on, Cliff and Ethel.
All right, glad to hear from you.
And even more so that you can call yourself an exoneree. But your story has a little bit of a twist to it. So give us give us the overview of your case and then the twist with regard to your settlement and things that's going on with there. So, Mr. Newton, if you would, you know, give our listeners a little bit of overview on your case.
Okay, the overview, I was arrested in 1984, tried, and for the charges of two rape charges, assault charges, attempt murder, kidnapping, and I was convicted of a rape, robbery, and assault. And basically, interesting thing about the case, they took me to trial, had two rape charges against the same victim. And I was acquitted of one of the charges and found guilty of the other charge. And you know, which was a repugnant verdict because the victim claimed that she was assaulted by the same person in different places during the course of the night. I was convicted, sentenced to 40 years for these charges, and interestingly enough that 2 years after I got convicted while I was upstate, I filed my first pro se motion trying to get ABO-type testing. This was before DNA testing, and the courts actually granted me testing and ordered the district attorney's office to turn over the rape kit at the time, and the sample was supposed to go to an independent lab called in Von Hollow called Life Codes. It was supposed to be inspected by independent scientists, but unfortunately, the sample never went to this laboratory. It went to the medical examiner's office in the city. Testing was never performed. I found this out subsequently later, even though the scientist signed off and said we did a test and no biological evidence was found to be tested. So after that, evidence disappeared. But I kept fighting the case. I kept fighting the case. In 1994, New York State passed a DNA statute law. The law actually came out in September of that year. I was one of the first guys in the state to file a petition, and it seems like this is where my real odyssey started. Now, because I had the power of the DNA statute, and I filed it under that petition, and I always believed, you know, that it was, you know, evidence in there to be tested, because during my trial, you know, there was talk of biological evidence when a scientist testified, you know, about the hospital rape kit and everything. So in 1994, when I filed this motion, basically everything disappeared. The district attorney's office, the police department, nobody was able to be able to explain to me or the courts where this evidence was. Every 6 months, every 2 years, I put in a new pro se motion trying to find evidence. I kept getting different excuses of what happened to it. And I only believe because they knew in 1988 there was biological evidence in there to be tested, so they had more of an incentive to keep hiding the evidence from me. But every 2 years, I put in a new motion. In 1998, my family and I, we hired an outside attorney, a private attorney. Let's see if we can do it. Hire an attorney, go at the courts and see if they can find anything. They found the victim's clothing. The victim testified that she felt something running down her leg after she was assaulted. She put her clothing on, so we found the clothing. There wasn't any biological evidence on the clothing. I kept putting in freedom of information requests in New York State, New York City, trying to get the evidence. And with this funny quirk in the law, they was trying to tell me that I was not even entitled to the evidence in my own case to be able to find it. Because they was telling me turning over evidence to me would jeopardize the victim or would make things known about the case, even though I took my case to trial and pled not guilty. So any evidence that would be out there that may exonerate me should have been turned over in the first place.
Absolutely.
Nevertheless, they still kept denying me access to any evidence in the case, even though they kept saying they couldn't find any evidence also when I was filing pro se motions. So eventually my family got in contact with the Innocence Project in New York State, in New York City, and they said, Alan, I had a staff attorney, Vanessa Popkin. She told me, she said, Al, you've been looking for this evidence for years. It's a good possibility we may not find it because it happened in a lot of other cases with them. Lo and behold, letters were sent to the district attorney's office in the Bronx, the police department, and they may have believed I was guilty because a letter was sent to the police department from the district attorney's office talking about let's find this man's evidence and bring this case to a closure once and for all because I was persistently filing motions with the courts, not just trying to, you know, get out of jail, but trying to prove that I was innocent at the same time. Because you always hear this talk, everybody in jail say they're innocent, but actually, right. I mean, 90% of the people that's in jail take pleas.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
My evidence was found. And when my evidence was found, I told my family if it's not tampered with, I'm coming home. because in starting in 2000, when I was getting ready to go to the parole board, New York State felt that I had to give up DNA evidence because I had a violent crime, and, you know, they wanted to test it against the registry and all that stuff, and I refused. So they threw me in solitary confinement for a little while, but, you know, eventually I realized I was fighting and losing battles, so I gave it up, and, you know, I was praying that it didn't wind up in this rape kit. In 2005, 2006 now, when they was testing it, though. But lo and behold, it was tested, and July 6th of 2006, I walked out of prison after 22 years, a free man. And the interesting quirk with this now, because my case had a statute of limitations, unlike a homicide case, New York City refuses to put their DNA in a database, the national database, to be able to find out if this person that committed this crime will turn up. So, you know, not only do they not are still trying to deny that I committed this crime, but also let's try to find a real perpetrator that may have done it, because the things I talk about now, Sam, is this becomes a public safety issue.
Exactly.
To go after the right person and just choose to arrest anybody, it's not like the person that committed these crimes or decide now that, okay, I'm not going to do this anymore, I'm going to take a break. No, they go on to commit more crimes. And a perfect example is the Central Park Five case in New York, because the person that actually committed that crime had committed a crime before that. And the MO was basically the same, and if it was just a little more, you know, investigation, or somebody saying let's go after the right person, or
right.
If it wasn't a different community, you know, the attitude would have been different. And, you know, I heard a lot of great callers, and one of the things I wanted to address is when I believe it was a woman was talking about accountability.
Yes.
We the people have to learn to hold the courts accountable, because only when we decide that, when we believe a case is bogus and we sit on juries and we decide to vote not guilty, that would force the district attorney's office and the police department to, okay, now we have to decide, now we have to go after the real person that committed this crime. And this
Absolutely.
Is what happened in a case like in Florida with the Jordan Davis case, is jury nullification. The jury
yep.
in that case decided, you know what, we're not going to convict this man of murder, but we're going to convict him of attempt murder. And it was an African-American young woman on the case, so we can't even just say it's about race, because she decided in her mind, according to the evidence she heard, I'm not going to convict this man of murder, but I'm going to convict him of something. And this is the same attitude that we have to take as people, because we have to get involved in the criminal justice system from the beginning. We can't be reactionary, decide, okay, something happened, and now I want to get out there and protest. Until we sitting in them jury boxes, not just on the witness stand, until we sit in them jury boxes and we can really start making decisions, and then we start forcing the courts, okay, they're not accepting these bogus cases anymore. Then we get better judges, and then we start forcing people to vote out these district attorneys like they just did here in Brooklyn, that's holding cases, you know, wrongful conviction cases, trying to hold people in jail for as long as they can. This is why they try to stay in office, because they have to try to cover up what they've been doing for years. And
you
we
know,
allowed it under this false thing of public safety, crew safety.
And you know, Alan, you raise a very good point about the jury nullification. You know, even in one of our in our primary case that we're working on with the IRP6, you know, that's something
okay.
We put out press releases every week. And we put out a press release over the last week. We put out one, and then we put another one this week with regard to that subject that you're talking about right now. People need to become aware of their rights as a jury, as a juror, and they should not be intimidated by a judge. They should not be swayed by bogus jury instructions. They need to understand that when they go into that deliberation room, that they can go against the grain and say that, I'm not going to vote with everybody else, and it's my right not to vote with everyone else. And, you know, in the case that I'm talking about with the IRP6, you know, the judge said some things that basically instilled fear in the jurors that made them basically come off as though that they had to come back with some kind of verdict. Otherwise, you know, she might hold them in contempt of court, or levy all the court costs on them. So, I mean, you make an excellent point. And in your situation, I mean, you spent 22 years in prison. It took over 11 years to get a DNA, to find the rape kit. And then once you find it, you know, obviously, you know, history pans out that you got exonerated in 2006. And then I'm looking here at the story, the lady who was raped, she ultimately died in 1991, never realizing that you are not the guy that committed this horrible crime against her. And so, you know, here's, I mean, this thing is far-reaching. And you know, we've talked about this over the last couple of shows, how, you know, wrongful convictions impact not only the person who was incarcerated, like yourself, but obviously it affected your family, it affected your extended family, your friends. In the Michael Morton case, you know, there was a juror on that case. We had her on the program here a week or so ago, Lou Bryan, and she was even talking about, you know, how much of an impact it had on her to realize that she was on a jury that wrongly convicted a man. So, Alan, in your case, because we only got about 3 minutes left, 3 or 4 minutes left on the show here, but in your case, you were awarded by a jury $18.5 million for a wrongful conviction. And then a judge came back and overruled that and basically took it back. I mean, that's like a slap in the face. You gave up 20 – you didn't give it up. They took 22 years of your life. You fought and fought and fought. And then they're going to take back what is rightful of yours. What's going on with that?
Well, you know, the interesting part about that is it's the same judge that ruled against the city of New York in the Stop and Frisk case. So that was the same judge that reversed the jury verdict 6 months later. It's the same judge that sat through the depositions and motions for 4 years on my case. And basically, she just, you know, simply misread the statute that talks about, you know, the right to be able to file a lawsuit against the city. And, you know, her excuse was that the city does not have to turn over DNA evidence to guys or, you know, defendants seeking it. They only have to tell us the last known location. And that's basically the gist of her argument, which is, was allowed to stand to basically nullify everybody I got exonerated on DNA evidence, because if the city only had an obligation to tell us, what would be the basis of the law, though? But the real problem with the city was a Monell decision, which basically saying that the city allowed it, the evidence preservation system becomes so decrepitated that they never was able to realistically be able to locate any old evidence for anybody. That was the real problem, because they was giving everybody seeking old evidence the same excuse, that it may have gotten burnt up in a fire, the paperwork. But the basic problem was they were throwing away the treasure map. They were throwing away all the evidence that basically gave you any access to where the evidence was, because the chain of custody forms came in six different parts. And you know how city government is. You had one agency writing evidence on the front, another one writing it on the back, another one writing it on the third page.
Yeah.
For years, decades, the left hand basically simply did not know what the right hand was doing to be able to locate evidence. And the interesting part, my evidence, because in 1988, when the testing was supposed to be done, it was supposed to be sent back to the Bronx storage facility. Yeah. But nobody in the Bronx came to pick it up. It was sent to a central storage warehouse. That may be the only reason that I'm out of jail now, because somebody did not do their job thoroughly, and that's why I'm out of jail now. And even talking about some of the causes of wrongful convictions, you know, Maurice was talking about...
Alan, we like 1 minute left. We're going to have you back on so you can tell us more about your story. We do apologize. We know that we got you on late. But we got to close it out, man. We appreciate you coming on to give us your story, and we are still pushing for you. You have a just cause on your side.
Alan Newton, our exoneree moment. Very interesting story. Yes, we are going to arrange to have Alan back. Ethel, how can people help out real quick?
Call Eric Holder's office, 202-514-2003 and 2005.
And that's for the IRP6, Gary Walker, David Banks, Dave Zappolo, Clint Stewart, Demetrius Harper, Kendrick Barnes. Go out to free the IRP6, that's the number 6, to find out more information about that. Also, to get in contact with Alan Newton, go to alan.newton@mail.cuny.edu.
We want to say thank you to everybody in the chat room, to our production crew, to our production support staff, and to The Truth. We know that you're out there. We appreciate it. Good night to everybody. We'll see you next time.
Good night, everybody.